I'll get a little day.
Okay, it's about 9:30 on the 2nd of August, and I'm here with John McGraw. Could you please tell me a little bit about the circumstances through which you came to be involved with the McMurdo Drive alleys?
Well, it was to do with my boss, who was, can you hear what?
Yeah, that'll be perfect.
Was Norman Taylor, and Norman Taylor was the director of our Soil Bureau, which was the foremost soil research institution in the country. It was a part of the Department of Scientific Industrial Research, DSIR. Now, Norman Taylor was a broad thinker in soils, and we had looked at soils in the tropical islands, mm-hmm. and right down through New Zealand, and he wanted to complete the arc, as he said. He wanted to know what the soils were in Antarctica,
yep.
to finish the sequence. There was another reason also, a bit more personal, dear Molly. Already in 1958 and so on, of course, the Americans were working there,
yep.
and some of them had taken grab samples, mm-hmm. just of soil, as they called it, and one had written a note about it and so on. Now, Norman Taylor was a bit concerned about the use of this word soil.
Yes.
He wanted to know whether there was soil in Antarctica before the other scientists started to use it.
Yeah.
It was very easy to talk about the soil, you know. So he decided that we'd have a look at Antarctica. It was easy enough because we had established Scott Base.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
We were already established the hangover from the days of Hillary and Fuchs and those
yes.
people. So the infrastructure was there. So he selected two of us. I was the leader of the two, and I suppose it was because I was used to working in the mountains of Otago, away in the south, rough country, camping out and so on. And he also selected a fellow called Claridge,
mm-hmm.
Graham Claridge, a soil chemist who was also a noted tramper and so on, and, you know, outdoor bloke. So the two of us were told to go down to Antarctica and to examine the soils and, if possible, draw a soil map of some part of Antarctica. Well, that was all right. We went down. We outfitted by the Antarctic division of DSIR, and away we went. We were flying down in an American plane, but halfway down we turned back because. Weather was bad, so we flew down for 8 hours for nothing. Had another night in Christchurch, set off again next day.
The boomerang flights, is that what they, the boomerang flights?
Yes, that's right. And it was bad enough because we got to Antarctica and the weather had crapped in again. And Antarctica was closed.
Oy.
But nothing you could do, we had to land, we didn't have enough fuel to get home. And we were talked down by radar. And it was quite an interesting experience, you know.
I can imagine.
we flew around in a square while they lined up the radar on us. This is the Americans. And then they said, okay, you're ready. So they said, you are 10 miles from runway, elevation 2,000 feet. And then and they relayed this chatter through the cavern, so it was quite good, you know. And I was quite amazed, really, the way they did it. The conversation sort of went like this. You are now 8 miles from runway, elevation 1,600 feet. And a few seconds later, you are now sort of 7 miles from runway, you know, and so on down like this. And then we got down. We couldn't see a thing out of the windows. It was white out. And then they said, you have crossed runway, elevation 200 feet, land your aircraft. Bump! And we were there.
That was it.
We were there.
That was 1958?
1959. Yeah. And we stepped outside into Antarctica. Luckily, they had this business of forcing you to get dressed as you went down, you know.
Yes, yeah.
So we had our anoraks on and various togs, so it wasn't too bad. But we had to go ashore. We're out in the ice, of course. We had to go ashore in a bulldozer. Claridge and I camped out in one of the out huts, and they broke us into Antarctica by two trips. The first one was only one trip. You think only one trip? We went up to visit the huts.
Right.
And
Cape Royds and Cape Evans.
Cape Royds. We went up to Cape Royds and camped in Cape Royds. Coldest place I've ever been in. It was an ice box, you know.
Yep.
He had no insulation, and snow had got into the walls of the building, so she was encased in ice inside.
Yep.
Not inside, but in the walls, like living in a refrigerator.
So you slept in the building?
Yeah. We slept on the floor there. They got the range going. They broke up some of the artifacts outside and got the fire going. And they managed to thaw their beer. That's all they did. I remember I held a thermometer about, I think, 2 feet out from the fire, and it still registered 0 degrees. So we weren't making much progress. Anyway, we had a couple of nights there and had lots of conversation with the penguins. And then we went down to Evans and we did a day's work excavating Evans. Evans was full of snow.
Yep.
In those days. They left a window open or something, and it was full of snow, and we excavated a corner anyway of it. Later on, of course, they excavated the whole thing.
Yeah, to be done, nicely.
Yeah. And that was so that was quite a good trip to break us in. We had to. At Evans, we slept in the big tents outside, you know, and got some idea of what camping in Antarctica was like. Now, one thing we learnt was that travelling in a sledge on the back of a tractor was a most unpleasant experience. We got showered with ice from the wheels of the tractor. And we got so cold that we got out and ran beside the tractor. And we learnt that. So we said, well, what we'll do is because we were getting ready for this big trip across to the dry valleys, is we'll make a box, a shelter box, to go inside the sledge.
Right.
So we went down to the dump and got a big packing case. It was a packing case about 8 feet long and about 3 feet square,
okay.
4 feet square perhaps. And we put a door on it and a window, and we fitted it up. And Claridge and I lay in that thing in our sleeping bags, but with the door open, I might say. while they towed us across in Meadow, you see.
So you didn't fly across the dry valley as you took?
No, we went across on a tractor.
Right. Yeah, tractor.
And with this, it's lying in this packing case.
Yeah.
We spent a night, what do they call those islands halfway across? Daly Islands, were they? Little islands somewhere between the mainland and Ross Island, anyway. We spent a night there, and then next day we pulled into the mouth of the Taylor Valley.
New Harbour.
Yes, yep. New Harbour. And the problem was that we couldn't take our sledges ashore, you see, onto the gravel.
Yep.
So we only could take the sledges as far as the beach. So we had to camp on the beach. And this is where this packing case came in. We took it out and tipped it up. It looked like a lavatory.
Right.
And we had arranged shelves, and it became our cookhouse.
Right.
Because that was the other thing that we didn't think much of, this business of cooking in our sleeping tent. You know, you make a mess with all the food and stuff. So here we had this hut, and we had a shelf, and we had our buns and our burner on it, our cooker, and a few shelves for things. And it was very, very neat and tidy. And I also used it as an office. I did all my drawing there and so on, you see. And we had the sleeping tent over there. And it worked out. That was our base camp. And it was just a few yards up from the seashore. On the side of a depression, which we didn't know at the time was a river. It was dry, of course. I remember we got quite a shock when we came back from up the valley and found water flowing down this thing within a few inches of our door of our hut.
And how long were you doing work in the dry valleys that season?
I think about a month. I'm not sure. I brought my books. I'll have a look and see. We spent the first few days or weeks just making short trips out from this new harbour over to the Commonwealth Glacier and up the hill and so on. And we did most of our detailed work just around there.
Right.
We soon found too that it was a good time between 4 and 5 in the morning to go out. There was no wind, the wind stopped for a short time. And that was a good time to take photographs.
Yep.
It wasn't very pleasant trying to take photographs in the wind. So we did a lot of field work at night.
Had you read any of the reports from Raymond Priestley, who was down there? So because he was doing some work around that end.
Yeah, I did.
The Shackleton expedition.
And as far as I could see, nobody'd ever been up through the Taylor Valley right to the top. They'd gone around the top and come in on the top, and they'd come up from the bottom, but nobody had gone through it.
Yeah.
So we spent quite a lot of time just on little and short trips messing around getting. We soon found out about Antarctic soils. They were upside down soils, as I called them. We had reverse leaching because you had permafrost at about 6 or 8 inches below the surface.
Yep.
And moisture came up and brought up salts with it.
Right.
So it left the salts on the surface. And almost every stone, of course, had a ring of carbonate or sulfate around it. The top soil was always full of salt. And as I said, it was reverse leaching. Instead of going down, it came up. That was the first step, the first thing we found out. But otherwise, they were soils in the sense they had a profile. They had a distinct top and bottom, But of course, no organic layer, you see. Only very rarely did we find soils with an organic layer around the penguins and so on. Bit of algae. We were trying to find some basis on which to differentiate soils, so-called. Well, it turned out, of course, you couldn't do much more than permamaterial, different kinds of moraines and things.
Yep.
Later on, Claridge, who got the settler, fell in love with Antarctica. He went back four or five or six times, and they found soils away out in the hills, which were much more weathered than our soils. He turned out our soils were almost desert soils.
Yep.
They were not weathered really, just raw soils. At any rate, so I mapped the topography and the slopes and things and the different kinds of moraines and parent material and where there was accumulations of salt and whatnot. And then the time came to go up the valley and have a look at the rest of the valley. We'd just been around with a short walking trips to the base. Now, this involved, of course, camping out up the hill. And we established another camp, a fly camp, on the shores of Lake Chad. Is that right? Yes. What's the first one? Frixel.
Yes.
Frixel.
Frixel, then you go past Canada Glacier.
Yeah, that's right. So we backpacked the tent up there and established a tent on the seaward end of Lake Chad. And then we found with a bit of experimenting that we could actually cook outside if we had our packs arranged to shelter the
right.
The primus.
Yep, from the wind.
You could actually get the primus going and cook out in the open. So what we did, we decided we'd do 24-hour days. We would tramp at work for 24 hours.
Yep.
Then go home and sleep. And that's what we did. We left the base, left the camp, that little tent at Lake Chad, and we walked right up to Taylor Glacier and down the other side back to the tent. And we did that in 24 hours.
So right round Lake Bonney?
Yes. Lake Bonney, hang on. Oh, yes, that's right, Lake Bonney. Lake Bonney takes you right into the glacier,
yes,
doesn't it?
Yes.
That's right, I'd forgotten about Lake Bonney. I was trying to think today, and I can't remember what we called the big block of land there. To get to Lake, to go past, to up, it was in Lake Bonney, really. You had a very narrow gorge to pass through.
Yes, the narrows.
Yes, but that block of land on the left-hand side looking up was called something.
The Bonney Regal?
The Regal.
Yep.
That's the word I've been looking for. Yeah, I couldn't think of what the hell that word was. I've forgotten it. Regal. Yes, the Regal. Yes, well, we went right round that, up through the gorge and over and back down. And that was really the extent of our work up the valley, was that one big long trip up there.
How many days did that last?
Just the 24-hour
okay,
day.
Okay, right.
We worked
One long day.
But most of our information about the soils came from the short trips around the base camp, right down at the seashore.
Yep.
And then we had to, after about, I don't know how long I was in there, I suppose about 3 weeks, time to go home, and the plan was that we would man haul home on the sledges. We had our sleds there. So we went down to have a look at the sea and found we couldn't get onto the sea. There was a layer of meltwater between the shore and the ice. So we were stuck. So we get on the old blower and says, you know, we can't manhaul home. We can't reach the sea ice. Oh, well, we'll send a chopper. So
that would have been late January, early February.
Yeah, it was a week or two, about a week into January.
Right.
Most of the time I was there was December. Most of the time I was in the Zwei Valley was December. Anyway, the chopper came and he was showed up the difference between the American culture and New Zealand culture as far as material goods were concerned. He didn't want to take the sledge home at all. He wouldn't put it on the chopper, you see. And he had all sorts of reasons why he shouldn't. But I had reasons too that he should. I pointed out that Hillary had taken his sledges by tying them on underneath somewhere. He could do the same. He was scared, of course, that it might come loose into his back thing. But on the other hand, you see, we had a different system from Americans. We understood that when things were shipped to Antarctica, they were written off up at Davidsville, Rhode Island.
Okay.
Where they're written off to Antarctica, and that was it.
Yeah.
But not New Zealand stuff. New Zealand stuff wasn't written off. We had to do stock taking down at Antarctica and account for everything. And the sledge was the first argument. I mean, he wanted to just leave it there. And we said, no, it's too valuable for that. We want the sledges. We persuaded him to take it.
So he took it in the end.
He took it in the end. The same, we had a jerry can still 3/4 full of power kerosene we used cooking. And he undid this and was going to upend it, you see. I mean, hey, you know, it's just a couple of gallons of good oil, which cost, they tell me it cost a fortune to get that stuff down there. And at any rate, oh, he didn't want to take that. But we persuaded him to take the can home too. So he took us home anyway, and that was very good. I remember, and with him, he had brought over a chap from the Bishop Museum in Honolulu, an entomologist. And he went around with a net trying to catch things, nothing much to catch. Little spring jumpers on the ground, of course. Bishop, oh, I've forgotten his name. Do you remember his name, David?
No.
He came here on the way home. Anyway, he came, he was a passenger on the chopper, just getting a ride. But I remember when we got back to Scott Base, they landed out on the sort of front lawn of the place, and they landed across the tide crack.
Right.
You see? I don't know, he didn't do it deliberately. I think he did it inadvertently. And this chap from Bishop Museum jumped down and went straight down the tide crack.
Oh, dear.
And on the way, he cracked his chin on the doorstep of the helicopter and knocked himself out. So he went flop back into this bloody tide crack. So we had to rescue him. And that was a little bit of excitement. It was always interesting, the hazardous flying down there. And then I remember that same trip. After we'd come back from the Taylor Valley and they landed on our front lawn, so to speak, we unloaded all our gear and the Cheerios of the pilot, and he took off and up again, down again.
Oh.
And I said, what's the problem? Oh, he wasn't sure, but something wasn't right. So they just left the chopper there on the ice, and we had to give them a ride back to McMurdo. And they came and towed the thing away after a while. And they'd probably put a new engine in it or something. They did that. So that was our trip.
And that was just the one time you went to the Dry Valleys, was that once?
That was the only time I was in the Dry Valleys. Claridge, I say, went back many times.
And in terms of the, you said you did a soil map of the lower.
I'm trying to find it. It's around the house here somewhere.
Okay.
It's mounted on three ply. It's the original map I made. Because I published something on it, didn't I?
Mm-hmm.
I can't just lay my hands in that map, though. I should be able to. It's a, thing about so-so.
And did you decide, so the question three about the scientific results of your work in the dry valleys, you said you went down to decide whether or not they were soils.
Yes.
Did you decide that they were soils?
Yes.
And why was that? Why did they classify as soils?
Because we said they had a movement,
mm-hmm.
a profile.
Right.
Which wasn't a sort of a normal profile, of course. It didn't have a topsoil.
Yeah.
But we're lacking in nitrogen, lacking in the carbon thing. Otherwise, they showed signs of leaching, as I said, but reverse leaching.
Yeah.
And those were the small things, but they were what we found.
Did you find nematodes or microscopic organisms in there?
Wasn't my job.
Okay.
No, we didn't look for those things at all. Claridge was a chemist.
Right.
And he took samples and he published separately.
Mm-hmm.
He's got a paper on the chemistry of the soils. He got his paper out about a year or two before me. Mine took a long time. We should have made them joint papers. That was the way they wanted it. Now, we made one mistake. We were told by one of our microbiologists she wanted samples for looking for bugs, you see?
Yeah.
And so, at any rate, we gathered up these samples and she set aside a set for her. But she didn't tell us they had to be kept frozen all the way home. And I don't know quite how we'd have done that. We'd have, I suppose, put them in the ship's freezer. But we didn't freeze them. And so she said they were useless. They had probably modern bugs, local bugs for the time they got home. So she didn't work on them. But she did later. I mean, Claridge later on got samples for her. Ah, yes. The biggest sample's that bit of rock there that I didn't collect, but one of my staff did on another expedition. It's a piece of orbicular granite from near the Beardmore Glacier.
From the Beardmore. Okay.
How he persuaded a helicopter pilot to bring that home, I don't know. But he brought it home and presented it to me.
So in terms of the question four is asking about changes in the environment of the dry valleys over the last 50 years or so since you were working there. Is there anything that you remember distinctly, for example, be able to take rocks away and different things that wouldn't be permitted now? Are there any sort of comments that you could make on the environmental changes and the regulations?
Oh, well, environmental wasn't very strong when I was there. People took souvenirs from the huts and took samples everywhere. No thought about this. We left our hut there. When we finished, we left
the
little thing
hut.
There.
Yeah.
And whether it's still there, I don't know. They've had several cleanups, and it probably suffered one of those cleanups. Although it was there until well into the 60s, if not the 70s, actually.
Did you have a name for it?
Not really, no.
It was just...
Although when I think about it, it's as old now as was Scott's hut and Royd's hut when we were there.
Yep.
When I was there, Royd's hut was 50 years old.
Yep.
And now, of course, that little hut of mine is 50 years old, if it's still there. But I'd think it'd probably been cleaned up. But with all due respect, the Americans were terrible. They had plenty of resources, of course. But when they went up tramping up the valleys, they got the helicopters to leave supplies, a dump.
Mm-hmm.
And the dump would have tents, even central heating in it. They had oil heaters and food and everything they wanted. So these guys just strolled from one camp to the other with their hands in their pockets, living the good life. But when they didn't bother taking these camps away, they just left them there. So we had a good time. We found, I remember finding a box of chocolate about this long, about a chocolate left behind, you know, things like this.
That was in the dry valleys?
In the dry valleys, yeah. Yes. They didn't, in those days, they didn't worry about cleaning up.
Yep.
But I understand later on, of course, there was a bit of a drive to clean the place up.
Yep, from the 1980s.
I guess that's all been fixed up now. Now, I can't tell you much about what's happened, but I understand that, you know, they've got rules and regulations now about what you can do and what you can't do.
And in terms of the question five with the logistics, you talked about being flown down with the Americans and then the American helicopter pilot coming to pick you up. Was there any interaction with American scientists while you were down there in terms of collaboration?
Not with me. There was no other... There was no nobody else that I... We had quite a bit of collaboration, contact with because we used to go over and eat over at McMurdo and things like that. And we relied on McMurdo quite a bit for all sorts of things. But there was no one anywhere near my field of work. Nobody looking at soils then. As far as I understand, I said before that certain chaps had grabbed samples.
Yep.
I suppose they were biologists, really. I'm not sure. No, there was nobody that I could really collaborate with. In fact, I don't remember attempting to find anybody, really. Although I suppose I knew most of who were there. Yeah. Now, the answer is no, there wasn't any collaboration.
So, logistical, the two programs are very much connected, but scientifically, from your experience, it wasn't.
Say again?
From a logistical point of view, it was connected. There were links, so you ate at McMurdo sometimes.
We relied on McMurdo to provide us with transport.
Transportation.
And... Oh, that's right. I also went to the way up the top. What do they call the place up the top end of the continent? We had a camp up there.
Is that Cape Adare?
Where?
Cape Adare.
Quite to Cape Adare. What the hell was it called? Anyway, the New Zealanders had a camp up there, and we flew up there too. You see, what would happen often, there was conversation between McMurdo and Scott Bayes every day, really, on the telephone.
Yeah.
And they had all sorts of weather reports and things to exchange. And McMurdo would say, look, we've got a flight going up to... so-and-so, anybody want to on the grot?
Yeah.
Well, the answer was often yes, we come. And I remember this flight, we went up to this camp, its name escapes me just at the moment. We'll come there. And then he flew on to Cape Adare, as you say,
right,
in the old DC-3. So while he was away, we had 2 or 3 hours around that camp.
Yep.
And they called it the banana belt. The temperature was quite high at times. High temperatures were a nuisance, by the way, because they used to melt the top.
Yep.
And the top got quite muddy and sloshy. And we were using those sort of canvas boots.
Yep.
Mainly. And they weren't suitable for anything wet, you see.
Right.
So we had to watch that. But the temperature rose to about 10 degrees at our base camp in the Taylor Valley on a good day, and that was a really hot day. And that caused all sorts of strife. It melted the surface, and you walked around like in a bog, you know.
Yep.
Because there was no drainage through, you see, with the permafrost. All the water was on the top. Yeah.
And one of the things I'm interested in with the people who were down in the 1950s and 60s is, did you read any of the Scott... Captain Scott's description of going into the dry valleys,
or
Griffith Taylor.
I had Scott's, I had a very good Antarctic library here, and I'd read all that material, and I knew. I was just thinking about Griffith Taylor. You know the Griffith Taylor's history. In the sense that he blotted his coffee book.
Yes.
In Australia.
Yes.
By telling them they lived in the desert.
The population question. And,
yeah, that's right. So he couldn't get much of a job, so he went to North America. Now, I wrote to him about that Lake Chad thing, where he got the name from.
Yep.
And of course he told me it was Navy toilet paper. Now, some time later, he wrote again, and I may have the letters in the file somewhere. And on this letter was a little piece of paper stuck here, just a little fragment of paper. And he told me that this paper was the paper in which they had preserved or pressed the plants they grew up at the camp they went to. They went further north than the dry valley.
Yes.
And they grew some lettuces or something, some sort of plants.
Yep.
And they grew about this high. And they preserved them, freshed them. And I laughed at this because he didn't send me one of the pressed plants. He sent me a bit of the paper in which they had pressed the plants, you know, just an ordinary bit of newsprint stuff. I think that was the last communication I had with that guy. What was his name again?
Taylor.
Yeah. He died shortly afterwards.
And then the final question two or three sentences, or just briefly, how would you sum up what did this experience in the Dry Valleys do for you and your scientific career after that?
Didn't do any harm anyway. I can say that. That report I read on the soils generated a lot of correspondence from various people, but I submitted that together with my work I'd done in Otago,
mm-hmm.
To Victoria University for a DSC. Now, DSC, you haven't got DSC.
That's a Doctor of Science.
Yeah. Yeah. You haven't got that in America.
No.
Well, you see, we had no PhD in those days. Nobody could do a doctorate here unless they went overseas. And only the wealthy ones could afford to go overseas to Britain or America. But you'll notice a lot of the older people, like myself, scientists, have got this DSC.
Mm-hmm.
And this was because they were persuaded to put their research work in. It was judged wholly on research work. You didn't have to do anything.
Right.
You'd already done it.
Yep.
It had to be published work.
Yep.
So you submitted your published work, and it was peer-reviewed overseas examiners and so on. And the Antarctic papers were obviously an important part of that. together with the work in Otago, which was on dry valley, on the dry part of New Zealand.
Yep.
It's only a 12-inch rainfall. Well, I was awarded a DSC. Now, that's what made a difference to my career. Once I had a DSC, I was a reputable scientist, and I was invited to take a job at the university here,
right,
which they were setting up.
Like it that,
was
yeah.
the beginning of a school of science at the University of Waikato, and I was a foundation professor there. Now, I wouldn't have been invited, without that DSC, I'd have never been invited to that job. So it made a big difference in my career, right? I shifted from being a field scientist to an academic. Yeah, and that didn't do my career any harm. Yeah.
Okay, I think that's 40 minutes, so I'll stop the recording there. Thank you very much.